Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Kimberly Fountain of the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, who talks about her group's effort to expand Social Security by scrapping the cap on what millionaires and billionaires pay into the system. Ellen Brown of the Public Banking Institute, who discusses government regulation and oversight of the nation's banks after the 2008 financial crisis and the public banking alternative she advocates. And Shoto Spring, a 64-year-old Zen Buddhist priest who talks about why she embarked on a 1,300-mile walk from the tar sands oil extraction region of Alberta, Canada, to Nebraska. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The long shadow of the 2009 coup against Progressive President Manuel Zelaya hangs over Honduras. In the coming November 24th national election, Zelaya's wife, Xiomara Castro, is a leading candidate for president of the new left-of-center Libre Party. Among other candidates, she faces pro-coup supporter Juan Hernandez of the right-wing National Party, who has pledged to establish a new 5,000-member military police force to combat rising violence. Since the coup and the installation of interim president Porfirio Lobo, Honduras has witnessed an increase in street violence, drug trafficking, corruption, and human rights abuses. According to a report by the Washington, D.C.-based Center for Economic and Policy Research, extreme poverty and economic inequality exploded after the coup, while the rich have prospered. The Libre Party is an outgrowth of the grassroots campaign that arose in opposition to the coup that overthrew Zelaya, whose progressive policies included doubling the minimum wage. The Toronto-based group Rights Action says 16 Libre Party activists have been killed since mid-2012, while other party members continue to face death threats and harassment. On the Muslim holiday of Eid al-Adha, thousands of recent migrants to Moscow flooded city streets to attend religious services at local mosques. The numbers of worshippers were so large at Moscow's six mosques that police intervened to do crowd control. On most days, predominantly Muslim migrants from Central Asia and the Northern Caucasus are invisible, working construction, warehouse, and restaurant jobs. But Muslim holidays, such as Eid, illustrate how the demographics of Russia are changing. According to Russia's Federal Migration Service, 1.8 million foreigners work legally in Russia, while another 3 million do so without government authorization. As Russia's energy boom fades and low-wage jobs disappear, nativist resentment against migrants is growing. A riot broke out in a working-class district of Moscow on October 10th after a local resident died in a fight with an immigrant from Azerbaijan. Hundreds of residents reportedly clashed with police while chanting racist and anti-immigrant slogans. The next day, Moscow police rounded up over 1,000 undocumented migrants, most of whom had nothing to do with the previous night's street battles. Over the past decade, low-performing students at the predominantly Latino Bowie High School in El Paso, Texas, were kicked out of school after they failed the Texas Assessment of Knowledge and Skills test. As a result, many aspiring students who ended up on the failure list had their dreams of higher education and future careers crushed. The state assessment test, known as TACS, which is mandated under the 2001 No Child Left Behind law, tests math and reading skills to evaluate the performance of both students and educators. Schools with a high number of failing students were under intense pressure to raise test scores or risk being closed down. In El Paso, the pressure led to an illegal scheme by the city's school superintendent, Lorenzo Garcia, to force low-performing students to leave school and enroll in adult education and GED programs. Eventually, an FBI investigation caught up with Garcia, who was convicted of fraud. He's now serving a 42-month sentence in federal prison. New York University education scholar Pedro Noguera told a news magazine In These Times that even if students don't get pushed out of school, high-stakes testing fails to increase their knowledge or ability to succeed in college. Noguera asserts that the achievement gap between affluent and poor students and white and minority students is about inequality. And, he says, we're not addressing inequality with high-stakes testing. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
Since the Republican Party took control of the U.S. House of Representatives after the 2010 congressional midterm election, the GOP majority has demanded massive budget cuts in federal programs. To further that austerity agenda, the Republicans have provoked crisis after crisis over the debt ceiling, fiscal cliff, the sequester, and most recently a costly 16-day government shutdown. Many conservative politicians focus their attention on reducing the federal budget deficit and parallel demands to reduce Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid benefits. Since 2011, President Obama has repeatedly stated his openness to trimming these programs in exchange for specific concessions in order to reach a so-called grand bargain agreement with the GOP. But despite a well-funded campaign to convince the American people that cuts to the nation's social safety net programs is both urgent and necessary, opinion polls find that Democrats, Republicans, and independent voters all reject these proposed cuts by wide margins. Now, a new coalition of groups led by the Progressive Change Campaign Committee has gone on the offensive, calling for expansion of the Social Security system. These groups and their allies in Congress say increasing Social Security benefits is critical in an age of shrinking pensions, and they say they can do it by scrapping the cap on what wealthy people pay into the Social Security system. Your reporter spoke with Kimberly Fountain, Social Security Expansion Campaign Director with the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, who explains the goals of this effort.
Right now, corporations have been slashing pensions. Protecting the current system is not enough. Americans really rely on this program more than ever. So we actually decided to go on offense so that we could push for more than the status quo and really give people the help that they need. And when it comes to the Harkin-Begich plan, which is what we've been promoting, it kind of does the antithesis to some of the cuts that you've been hearing about. So unlike the president's proposal to cut Social Security benefits through chain CBI, the Harkin-Begich plan actually gives a worker $452 more per year by age 75 and $807 more per year by age 85. And the Harkin bill also has an additional increase of almost $800 a year. And the way that it's all paid for is by ensuring that the wealthy pay the same rate as everyone else into Social Security, something that we like to call scrapping the cap. This way we can pay for those benefit increases that we desperately need and still have enough left over to add to Social Security's solvency. And one of the things that you don't hear very much about is that there is a $2.7 trillion surplus. So this increasing solvency would actually be beyond that.
Say a few more words about scrapping the cap. Outline for us one more time, if you would, what the current cap is on contributions from the wealthy on contributing to Social Security, and what you'd like to see happen as opposed to the current cap.
Yeah, so the current cap is around $113,000. And what's interesting is it wasn't always that way. The wealthy used to pay their fair share into the system. So all we want to do is bring it back to that them paying their fair share. So literally removing that cap, making everyone pay their fair share into the system so that we extend the solvency and increase benefits because, again, you know, things like pensions and unreliable 401ks, they're just not there anymore.
What are we talking about in terms of increases of payments by the wealthy when it comes to lifting this cap? You done any estimates of how much revenue could be raised like that and, you know, what the potential bite is on individual wealthy families?
It's very, very small. I don't have the exact number in front of me, but it's around less than like 0.2% or something, but I can get that to you. But it's very small, and really, you know, what's happening right now is the rest of us are paying our fair share. So it's just about us all paying into the system because this program is for everybody.
One of the things I'd like to explore with you about the polling is the interesting fact, and correct me if I'm wrong, that so-called or self-described Tea Party activists are as equally against cuts in Social Security and Medicare as are the rest of the population. So these self-described ultra-conservative activists really reject this, you know, what we're told is the establishment conservative solution to saving the social safety net programs, which are cutbacks.
Yeah, the truth is this is not a partisan issue. Both Democrats, independents, and Republicans, they all want Social Security expansion.
Kimberly, tell us a little bit about the actions that you're advocating here to expand Social Security, namely petitions and other things that you're planning.
Sure. So again, to go to our petition, you can go to expandsocialsecurity.com. And what's so amazing about this campaign is that we just started a couple of months ago. And a couple of months ago, you weren't really hearing very much about it. But since then, we've been able to collect close to 650,000 signatures in support of expansion. Pretty exciting. We've built a huge coalition. We've been working with groups like Social Security Works, Now, Democracy for America, AFL-CIO, and many others. We've lifted up our growing number of heroes. In the Senate, folks like Senator Harkin from the rural state of Iowa, Mark Begich from the red state of Alaska, Brian Schatz and Mazie Hirono from Hawaii, and now our brand new champion, Senator Sherrod Brown from the purple state of Ohio. And then we've also built some in the House as well, like Linda Sanchez from California, Mike Honda from California, Rosa DeLauro from Connecticut, Alan Grayson from Florida, and many more. We've also been able to do some polling from states as diverse as Kentucky, Iowa, and California, showing that expanding Social Security benefits is actually popular by over 2-1. And in Texas, Colorado, and Hawaii, it's 3-1. And for folks that want to see more about our polling, you can go to 2014polling.com. Again, that's 2014polling.com. But again, by us generating this momentum for Social Security expansion through the things we've recently done, we're taking benefit cuts off the table and really giving progressives a great issue to run on in 2014 and paving the way for helping millions of our grandparents and our veterans as we celebrate on this Veterans Day.
That was Kimberly Fountain, Social Security Expansion Campaign Director with the Progressive Change Campaign Committee. For more information on the campaign to expand Social Security, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The tentative agreement by J.P. Morgan Chase Bank to pay the U.S. Department of Justice $13 billion to settle civil investigations into mortgage-backed securities in the period before the 2008 financial meltdown is the largest such settlement on record. But the deal ran into several obstacles in late October, when J.P. Morgan Chase argued that it should not be responsible to pay for errors made by Washington Mutual, the bank it purchased after the housing bubble burst and the world's financial system went into crisis. In one of the few trials linked to the 2008 financial meltdown, a federal jury in New York found the Bank of America liable on one civil fraud charge on October 23rd. Countrywide, a unit of Bank of America, was accused of issuing defective home loans in a process referred to as the hustle, which were then sold to government mortgage lenders Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. The Justice Department is seeking more than $848 million in penalties, equivalent to what Fannie and Freddie lost. There are few such examples of the U.S. government holding big banks accountable for their reckless or illegal behavior, which many economists point to as being a large part of the abuses that led to the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression. And when the government does intervene, more often than not, the Justice Department imposes fines but defers criminal prosecution of bank executives, leading many to observe that America has a double standard for justice when it comes to too big to fail financial institutions. Your reporter spoke with Ellen Brown, chair and president of the Public Banking Institute and author of the book The Public Bank Solution, From Austerity to Prosperity. Here, Brown takes a critical look at government regulation and oversight of the nation's banks and discusses the public banking alternative she advocates.
Well, that $13 billion settlement is huge. It's the biggest ever, and it sounds like a big penalty on J.P. Morgan. But actually, $10 billion of that is there's just basic contract violations for the investors. So it doesn't help the homeowners. It's money that will go to the defrauded buyers into these mortgage-backed securities. So investors in mortgage-backed securities are collateralized debt obligations. J.P. Morgan knew that when they bought Washington Mutual, they knew that there was the potential of these lawsuits, and they had set aside money for that, and they're getting tax benefits from it. And so basically it's cost of doing business, and it's not really going to slow them up from their practices. Now, the Bank of America one is more interesting because it's about fraud in the origination of these mortgages. So that sets a precedent for homeowners who could, all across the country, homeowners could go in and say, if their mortgage was brought in the name of MERS, the Mortgage Electronic Registration Systems, if the real lender was not on the note, so the lender appeared to be the bank, but actually the lender were these investors, their money never actually made it into the trust that supposedly it's a whole chain of title issue, which gets pretty complicated. But the thing is, that could be a real headache for the banks. I mean, like, that could seriously bring down some major banks if lawsuits were pursued along that line. But on the whole question of regulation, I think it's just not possible to solve the problems of a private banking system with regulation, because what really went wrong in the fall of 2008 was not that the housing bubble blew up because of subprime lending. It was a run on the money markets, which happened when Lehman Brothers went bankrupt, and the money market is part of the shadow banking system, which Dodd-Frank doesn't even attempt to regulate much of the shadow banking system. That's all quite complicated, but any regulations that you set up, they can find a way around it as fast as you can set them up. It's all in the shadows. It's not even happening, in obvious, transparent way. So it seems to me that ideally, if you want to get to solutions, banking needs to be a public utility and not just merely regulating private banks that then can do what they want with the proceeds, but the proceeds themselves should belong to the public and should be directed back into the economy for public purposes. That's the only way to create a sustainable system.
What progress has been made in your efforts at the Public Banking Institute to further the idea that establishing public banks in states or counties or municipalities, how that could take root and strengthen the public control of our financial system?
Well, we've generated a lot of interest. We haven't yet to set up another state-owned bank like the Bank of North Dakota, but I think people are definitely aware of the issue now and the possibilities. And I've written about my latest book is called The Public Bank Solution, where I looked around the world at other public banking models, since people would say about the Bank of North Dakota, well, that's only one state, only one bank. They're different from us. They're smaller. They have oil, et cetera, et cetera. So I looked at all these other countries, and I was very surprised myself to find that 40% of banks globally are publicly owned. They're largely in the BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, which have 40% of the global population. And they also escaped the credit crisis, and it was largely through their banking system. So I think what we're doing a lot of in the Public Banking Institute is just spreading awareness or information or an understanding of our banking system, what's wrong with it, and what the possibilities are. I was just writing about Costa Rica, which I only know about because somebody wrote to me from Costa Rica and said 80% of our banks are publicly owned. The people refuse to give them up because they're so secure and they work so well, and they've been funding infrastructure and their whole economy for half a century now. So there are these models that we just don't hear about, but definitely possibilities, things that we could do. And I think that's what we have to do, is set up an alternative system and quietly move into it, or have something ready that we can move into before we see the violent revolution that's liable to come if we do have a massive run on the banks because of a bail-in or something like you see in third world countries when they have revolutions. You need to, typically you have a violent revolution, and then what they wind up with is a military dictatorship or something worse than what they had before, because nobody has really thought through. They know they don't want the existing system, but they don't know what they do want, or they haven't agreed on it, or they don't have it set up as a matrix. So that's what I think we need to do, is have something set up that we can move into.
That was Ellen Brown, chair and president of the Public Banking Institute and author of the book, The Public Bank Solution, From Austerity to Prosperity. For more information on public banking, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. From July to early October, Shodo Spring, a 64-year-old Zen Buddhist priest who is a mother of two and grandmother of four, led a walk from the tar sands oil extraction region of Alberta, Canada, to Nebraska, 1,300 miles along the proposed route of the Trans-Canada Keystone XL pipeline project. After being arrested in Washington, D.C. in August 2011, during a protest against the pipeline that would transport dirty tar sands oil to Texas refineries for export abroad, Spring decided to walk the route to meet people on all sides of the controversy and to bring peace to the area. She says the central impulse for the Compassionate Earth Walk, as it's called, was a response to climate change, which she believes is the most likely cause of the current droughts, floods, and extreme weather events the world has witnessed in recent years. Spring asserts that the situation will get much worse unless people collectively take drastic action. She made the entire journey, walking about half the miles, while a corps of 6 to 8 others walked in either Canada or the United States. Other participants joined the walk for shorter periods along the way. Growing opposition to the extraction of tar sands oil has been provoked by scientific research that finds the energy source produces far more greenhouse gases that contribute to global warming than conventional production methods. President Obama is expected to make a decision on whether or not to approve the Keystone XL pipeline project sometime in 2014. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Shodo shortly after she finished the walk and returned to her home in Minnesota. Here she shares some reflections from her journey and summed up what she considers the walk's impact.
There was a rancher in Alberta who we met through a church, and we had dinner at his house and a very lovely conversation about the whole thing, you know, the climate change and what can you do and what can't you do and everything. But he took us out to his ranch where he was keeping part of it as native prairie. But he actually drove a considerable distance to come and talk with us. I wanted the walkers to hear from him because I had met him last year. And it's coming across his land. And he refused to sign. And they took him to court and he lost. So what happens is TransCanada comes in and they have a contract for an easement. And most people say, oh, look, money, and they sign it. So you're getting some money, and you're doing a good thing because you're helping there be energy for people, and it's needed. Some people have gotten together in groups and bargained for better easements is what they usually do. And then a very few people just refused to sign. And he said he wasn't against the pipeline in the first place, but they lied to him so much that they turned him against the pipeline. People keep saying lying and double-dealing and refusing to answer questions, and high-pressure tactics. He was referring to the Cowboy Indian Alliance. He said it had put him in contact with so many different kinds of people that he never would have been involved with. You know, he would have stayed with the people who were like him. And instead, he's become totally easy with people of all different kinds.
And the Cowboy and Indian Alliance, that's white ranchers and indigenous folks who are all against the pipeline. Is that right?
Right. I mean, what a great title, right? And of course, the great thing which we observed, they've observed, everybody has noticed is, oh, look, the same people who came and took, or that their ancestors came and took the land away from the Indians, now need help from the Indians to protect their land, which used to be the Indians' land, because treaty rights are major, major help.
Would you say that in general, people in Canada and in the U.S. have a different attitude about the pipeline?
Not exactly. In Canada, you know, we met a few people who were against the pipeline, but mostly not. Most people were for it. Oh, but there were some farmers and ranchers who were kind of grumbly about it because they can't get farm help anymore. Because you can make $28 an hour right out of high school if you go to work for the oil industry, oil and gas. And the farmer can't afford to pay $28 an hour. So this one guy that we camped at his place, he said he could have gone with, I don't know if he meant sold his land or whatever, but he wouldn't do it. But it's really hard to do agriculture anymore because the labor force is going where the money is. It seemed like till we got about halfway through South Dakota, most people were pro-pipeline. They weren't thinking about oil spills, and they weren't thinking about climate change. We heard more of the religious thing there. God's in charge. And then, like, southern South Dakota and all of Nebraska, the people we saw were like, it was all about pipelines and spills and the aquifer, and they're ruining our lands, and they're violating our rights and everything.
Shoto Spring, what did you set out to accomplish, and do you feel like you accomplished it?
The single clear intention that we all had was to walk every foot of that way. And we took turns, so what walking every foot meant was the staff went every foot. And except for 3 miles where there was road construction and they shuttled the walkers and there was no option, we did that. So that we accomplished. Other things were, you know, we did have a lot of positive encounters with people. We don't know what the effect of those encounters was. Certainly the people who are anti-pipeline frequently felt encouraged and inspired by our being there. The group that was on the walk, I think, learned a lot. There were people who just kind of stumbled into it, and they learned a lot about politics and activism and Native issues and all the stuff that came up there. But the people who came more intentionally, they matured in being able to work in a group. People were speaking in front of groups, not often, but everybody, they made beautiful statements. And so I think in terms of building activists, we had a positive effect.
That was Buddhist priest Shoto Spring. Find links to more information about Shoto's Compassionate Earth Walk and tar sands oil extraction by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.